to call, no one to rush home to. But when has she? She reviews the few possibilities. Earl, her mother, her father who died before she knew him, Luke's father for only a little while, Rex for too long, for which she will never forgive herself, Luke, June. None of these people were ever hers. They either belonged to someone else, or had lives or lies that put them out of reach, or should have. This is not news, but what surprises her after being alone for so long is that it's only now that it feels unbearable. The sidewalk that leads to town is slick with leaves. They turned color late this year, some as late as Halloween, and clung to their branches until a nor'easter blew in and finally knocked them to earth. They are everywhere. She wants to run, but instead walks slowly, careful not to slip and cause another scene as she passes in front of the auto shop, the hospital thrift store, the flower shop, the historical society, the fabric store, the town library, the elementary school. Each day, even in the rain, she walks. Her car, an old light blue Chevy Lumina, parked behind the apartment building where she lives, hasn't been driven in over a month. She only ever used it for cleaning jobs, and if she needed to go somewhere in town, she always saved gas by walking. The grocery store and the coffee shop are her only destinations now, and she goes to both on foot. She walks past St. David's, where Luke's funeral was held, the same church her mother took her to on Christmas Eves and Easter Sundays when she was growing up. "Whether God is or isn't, we cover the base," is what she'd say. And for that reason insisted she and Earl get married there, too. Luke's funeral was the first time Lydia had stepped foot in the place since her wedding day, and it surprised her that nothing had changed in over 30 years. The same dark wood, the same gloomy stained glass. "God isn't," she whispered that day, to herself and to her dead mother. And if he was, Lydia knew he'd long ago looked past her. She walks past the small house she grew up in next to the firehouse, the two-family Victorian where she lived when she was married, briefly, the apartment above Bart Pitcher's garage where her mother lived the last 15 years of her life, the apartment 3 streets away, behind the liquor store where she went to live after her divorce was final and where she raised Luke. She should have left this town by now, she thinks, ducking under a low-hanging branch. There is no one here, but there is no one anywhere. For a while there was, when Luke was young, and it was just the two of them. But as he grew older, he found swimming and friends, and started to occupy a world apart from her, even though they lived under the same roof. Then much later, after prison and years of avoiding her, he came back, and only because June made him. That began a brief time, so anomalous and happy, she remembers it now as if she'd made it up. Like a fable in which some wretch is given a glimpse of paradise only to have it snatched away. She is that wretch. Luke, letting her back in his life, and with him June, so much more than she expected. And now both of them, in a puff of black smoke, gone. She kicks at a pile of leaves that have been raked and left uncollected on the sidewalk, and considers the thousands of times she's walked here, as a little kid, a teenager, a mother, and now. She can't imagine anyone walking these sidewalks as many times as she has. "My feet are famous to these sidewalks," she thinks, and the idea almost amuses her, its novelty breaking for a split second the panic that drove her from the coffee shop. She holds her breath as she walks past the cemetery, perhaps the only childhood superstition she still holds on to. She clears the street corner that marks the end of the property and exhales, imagining all the thwarted ghosts, including her parents, who wait inside the cemetery gates for her to join them. Luke is buried in the small cemetery behind St. John's Church, where Lolly Reed was supposed to be married. It's across the road from where June's house had been and seemed to Lydia the obvious place. In addition to Luke's plot, she bought 2 more, one for her, and though she never had the chance to tell her, one for June. As she crosses the street and rejoins the sidewalk, she has a sharp sense that someone is behind her. She thinks she hears footsteps, but when she stops and turns around, no one is there, just a teenager riding his bike on the street, heading in the opposite direction. "The ghosts are out today," Lydia remembers her mother saying on dark winter days like this. She starts walking again, faster now, and remembers how Luke once called her a ghost. He didn't say it kindly, and it was before he began to forgive her, before June. He was standing in the section of the grocery store where the ice cream and frozen pizzas are displayed in clear doored freezers. She had seen him enter the store and followed him in, kept a distance as she watched him move from aisle to aisle and fill his cart. He'd been out of prison for an entire summer, and she'd still not spoken to him, even though she'd left him many unanswered notes and phone messages. His shirt was too small, and it rode up his back as he bent to lift a bag of ice. She could see the thick cord of his spine and the muscles on either side wriggling like snakes under his dark skin. "How on earth could I have created something so beautiful?" she thought. When he saw her, he stood still and stared for several seconds, and then began to turn away. But before he did, he stopped abruptly and spat, "Go away, ghost." She crosses the village green toward the small apartment building where she has lived on the first floor for more than 6 years. She climbs the rickety porch steps and notices she left a lamp on in the living room. She figures a moth of some kind must be banging against the bulb, because the light dances and casts small, fast shadows across the couch, the chair, the wall. She pauses at the door and lets herself see for a moment what she imagines most people come home to. Lit rooms, voices, someone waiting. It is raining now. Somewhere on Upper Main Street, a metal mailbox slams shut. She thinks she hears footsteps again, this time rushing away, but soon there is only the sound of raindrops tapping the fallen leaves, the parked cars, the gutters. She closes her eyes and listens. No one calls her name. There are no more footsteps behind her, but still she turns around before unlocking the door and stepping inside. She takes a long, late-day look at the town where she has lived her whole life, where there are no friends, no family, but where her feet are famous to the sidewalks. Rick. My mom made Lolly Reed's wedding cake. She got the recipe from a Brazilian restaurant in the city where she went one night after going in with her friends to see a show. It was a coconut cake made with fresh oranges. She prepared for days. It didn't have any pillars or platforms or fancy decorations. Just a big sheet cake with a scattering of those tiny, silver edible balls and a few purple orchids she had special ordered from Edith Tobin's shop. She was proud of that cake. She bakes and decorates cakes for all the birthdays in our family. And she made the wedding cake for my sister's wedding and mine. So when June Reed hired us to cater her daughter Lolly's wedding, I thought, why not? Unfortunately, she never got paid. I didn't either. Not a cent. And if June Reed had tried to pay me, I would have torn up the check. I couldn't accept money from that woman after what she'd been through. My wife Sandy saw it differently, still does, but that's her business and this is mine. We own Feast of Reason together, and technically she has a right to complain, but I wasn't and am still not about to pester June Reed for a few dollars. $22,000 to be exact, but who's counting? I should have worked up a contract like Sandy was always on me to do. At least we would have had half the money up front. But I never got around to drafting one and running it by a lawyer to make sure it covered all the bases. Lolly Reed's wedding was only the second big event we'd been hired to cater, and we were still getting the farm market and cafe off its feet, making sure everything was up to code. If you want to lose sleep at night and eliminate all your free time or freedom, by all means open a small business, especially one that serves food. No one tells you about health inspectors or wheelchair access when you're first thinking of opening a place that serves the perfect lentil soup, fresh baked bread, and almond milk cappuccino. It's a good thing they don't, because otherwise there would be no restaurants or cafes or coffee shops anywhere. I'm not sure why we thought the catering bit was a good idea, but it gives people you like a way to make some cash. Also, it's flattering to be asked to make the food for someone's important day, wedding or graduation or birthday. And when it's someone like June Reed, who could have had anyone from the city come up and do a first-class job, Well, for us it was a big deal. When she and Lolly came in and asked me if we'd be interested in making the food for the wedding, there was no way we were going to say no. June Reed would have been a hard woman to say no to anyway. She had that Glinda the Good Witch vibe to her, a sort of nothing bad has ever happened to me and nothing bad will happen to you if you're around me feel. She was pretty in the way that some of the older women in my wife's soap operas are pretty. She took care of herself. She smelled good, too. Like I don't know what, but nice. I guess she probably still does, but we haven't seen her around here in a while. She took off months ago, and who can blame her? She pulled herself together for the funerals, kept her distance from everyone in town, and then was gone. June Reed had been coming to Wells on the weekends with her husband and daughter for years, and then later, on her own, when she moved here full-time. No one ever made a fuss or thought twice about her, but when she shacked up with Luke Morey, the whole town paid attention. This was more than a couple of years ago, and at the time she must have been at least 50, about twice Luke's age. Sandy and her friends never got tired of talking about it. They just couldn't accept that he would hitch his horse to her wagon, or however the phrase goes, especially since Luke had more than plenty of wagons to choose from. We grew up together, went to the same elementary and high school, played on a lot of the same sports teams too until high school when he dedicated every free second he could to swimming. And Jesus, could he swim. Perry Lynch used to joke that it's because his people were from Cuba or Puerto Rico and came to this country by swimming to Florida, but like with most things, Perry got it wrong. Luke's mom Lydia was white, but his dad, whoever he was, must have been straight up black and not Hispanic or Latino or whatever you call it. In any case, Luke swam like a fish and broke school and state records and even got recruited by a few big universities, including Stanford, for scholarships. Stanford! He had the touch and had his pick of girls, schools, and futures. But then it all fell apart. All at once, bam, he was just like the rest of us, worse even. He got snagged for moving coke from Connecticut to Kingston, and his whole life collapsed. He ended up serving 11 months in a prison in Adirondack, New York. It was unbelievable, and the shittiest part was that the whole thing was rigged. Everybody knew Luke had nothing to do with drugs in high school. He was always too focused on swimming and keeping in shape. He drank like the rest of us on weekends. He even passed out once on the town green coming back from a party when we were sophomores. Strange to think how much of a big deal that was back then. Everyone knew about it, and someone must have called Gus, the town cop, because he was the one to come down, wake him up, and walk him home. Luke wasn't perfect, but for him to get caught with a major cocaine haul made no sense. It still doesn't. I'd heard that his mother Lydia somehow had something to do with it, one of her shady boyfriends. And later I was told by a guy who works in the Beacon Police Department that Luke had been screwed into pleading guilty by a lawyer and a crooked judge who were protecting bigger fish. Whatever went down, Luke never said anything about it to me or anyone else I know. After he got out, he came back to Wells, got jobs here and there, and eventually started his landscaping business. One thing about Luke is that he never talked shit about other people. He could be moody and sometimes lose his temper, but he didn't talk trash. That his mother had been gossiped about so much over the years must have had something to do with it. Who knows? Even when he'd started seeing some girl, it was always from somebody else that I'd find out. Growing up, the rest of us practically took out ads in the paper when we got to first, second, and third base. And home run? Jesus, everyone had to know, and usually within a few hours. But not Luke. He played it cool, like when he started up with June Reed. Sandy's the one who told me. She keeps tabs on everyone, and by the time I found out, he was already living in that old stone house on Indian Pond Road. I must have seen him once or twice a week back then, and he never mentioned it. When Luke first got out of prison, his swimming coach from high school, Mr. Delinsky, got him a job lifeguarding at the town beach. I was down there all the time with Sandy and Liam, who was just an infant. It was before we started Feast of Reason, and I was still working evenings, mostly on the weekends for a catering company in Cornwall. My days were free, and we were living with my mother, so we would park Liam on a towel at the lake and kick back. Luke was there, and Jesus if he didn't get big in prison. He always kept his shit tight, but with swimming, the guys never got too bulky. He must have lifted weights every day because it looked like he'd put on at least 20 pounds of muscle. He was ripped. He'd be up on that white chair looking out over the kids splashing around in the algae-covered lake, black as a berry and built like an Olympian. It's a weird thing to say, but he was like a movie star or a famous athlete. too big, too handsome, too something for the likes of us. No one around here looked like he did, and I don't just mean because he was black. I caught Sandy looking at him more than a few times, and I thought, what the heck, who can blame her? He worked as a lifeguard for most of that summer. By August, a few of the mothers who took their kids to the lake complained about the town hiring someone fresh out of jail, and he had to give up the job. After that, he started helping with Steve Pitcher's estate management company, raking leaves, cleaning gutters, clearing brush. He did that for a couple summers, and in the evenings and in the winter, I got him a few cater-waiter jobs for big events at Harkness. The company I worked for had a contract with the boarding school for their fancier alumni events, and we always needed help. I'd watch Luke move through the room fetching coffee and pouring wine for these white-haired, old bankers and lawyers in blue blazers, and think, there was something very wrong. At that point, he would have been a sophomore at Stanford, winning races, planning a future filled with nights like this, but with him being waited on and not the other way around. It's not that I think one life is better than the other. Hell, I'll be serving white-haired New Yorkers in blue blazers the rest of my life. But it's just that this wasn't the life he was supposed to live. Anyone who knew Luke in high school could tell he was not long for our town. Of all the lazy potheads and drunks we grew up with, who one way or another have managed to live off disability checks, insurance settlements, or both, who would have ever guessed that it would be Luke Morey who would be buried here at 30 years old? No one, that's who. Not even Dirk Morey or his old man Earl, who used to be married to Luke's mom. Those crazy, red-headed Moreys never liked Luke, and fair enough, they had their reasons. But the truth is that Luke never did anything to them besides being born and having the same name. It didn't matter. He was always in their crosshairs, and in a town as small as Wells, you're bound to cross paths with everyone, even the people you want to avoid. And despite the fact that Dirk was a little guy and a few years younger than us, he was always just over our shoulders cracking jokes, giving Luke a rough time. Luke could take care of himself, but there were a few times some of us had to step in. Dirk's the only person I have ever punched, and the night I did, he had it coming. It'd be one thing if we were still kids, but this was only a few years ago. We were leaving the elementary school cafeteria where the volunteer fire department has its monthly spaghetti dinners. Everyone goes. They always have. June and Luke had already walked out, and Dirk was behind me and Sandy. "Looks like he found a broad just like his mother," he said, poking his finger into my back and looking up ahead at Luke and June. I ignored Dirk, as most of us do when he's had a few too many beers. Usually, he'll shut the fuck up and move on, but not that night. "Some of them just like dark meat, I guess. Funny thing, eh, Rick?" He poked my back again, and I could feel my fists clench. Luke and June were only a few yards ahead of us, but I don't think they could hear. And then, making sure everyone in the cafeteria could hear, "Difference is this rich cunt pays for it." With that, I spun around and decked him. Half the town at one time or another has wanted to deck Dirk Morey, and some of them have. He's been hauled out of the tap almost as many times as his father. The Moreys are loud drunks, but they're little guys, wiry, and as aggressive as they can get, they usually avoid a brawl. Problem is that there are so many of them around here. Dirk always feels free to mouth off because there are usually two or three cousins nearby to defend him if he gets in a scrape. His family is the volunteer fire department, so he must have felt bigger than usual that night. It was lucky that Luke got to me before any Moreys did, because after I hit Dirk the first time, I shoved him to the floor and dove in. I'd heard this guy heckle and mouth off since we were kids, and I'd saved up a few swipes over the years. I got a couple good ones in too before Luke dragged me off to the parking lot. June Reed stood to the side while Luke made sure I wasn't going back in for more. But when Sandy and I started walking to our car, June ran up and grabbed my hand. Not a thank you, no words. She pulled one of my hands into hers, squeezed it, and let go. She was looking down the whole time, so I couldn't see if there were tears on her face, but she was upset. She rushed back to Luke before I could say anything. I didn't know much about June Reed before she started seeing Luke. I knew the house, it was one of the oldest in Wells, and I remember going there as a kid at Halloween for candy and being frightened because the place looked haunted. It's funny to imagine that she would have been roughly my age now when I came knocking at her door in my He-Man costume. When I first heard about her with Luke, I thought it was a little weird, but when I saw them together, I was mostly glad to see Luke lighten up, begin to have fun again. He was a pretty depressed guy when he came out of prison, and he didn't hang out much. He crashed in a room above Mr. Dolinsky's garage for those first few months, and then got an apartment near the hospital. I'd see him at the lake and then at Harkness, but besides that he kept to himself, went to the gym at the high school, and still swam laps in the pool. I saw him there with June a few times, working out. I think it was the first time I heard him laughing or saw him smiling since high school. I remember one time watching him attempt to teach her a complicated exercise with free weights, and was surprised to see how quickly he got frustrated by how uncoordinated she was. She didn't seem to mind, and instead teased him by mimicking his serious face and exaggerating his careful movements. He was clearly annoyed, but she was relentless, and eventually he couldn't help but smile. I don't think most people would have expected June Reed to have a silly side, but she did, and I think it was just one of the number of things about her that brought Luke back to life. When my mother found out what happened, she asked me to bring the cake down to the firehouse for the guys who'd been called out to June's place that morning. Dirk Morey was there when I arrived, and so was Earl, along with all the others. For once, these guys had nothing to say. I brought the cake into the kitchen and told Dirk's cousin Eddie that I'd come back next week for the tray. I got out of there as fast as I could. I didn't want to hear any of the grisly details. I just wanted to get home to Sandy and Liam and lock the door. I started back to our place, but for the first time since my dad died when I was in 8th grade, I started to cry. Maybe it was because both were accidents. My dad's car got hit head-on by a drunk driver on Route 22 after he picked up some part for Mom's dishwasher. Or maybe it was because Luke had become a friend. We were always friendly growing up, but he had his eyes elsewhere, girls, swimming, college, and for better or for worse, we never were that tight. But after he got out of jail and was up and running with his landscaping business, we saw each other all the time. He'd swing by with the Waller boys for a cup of coffee and a pastry in the mornings while we were opening up. We never got too deep into anything, never talked about his arrest or his time in jail or the life he missed out on. But I knew he and his mom were patching things up after a lot of years of not speaking. He never said a word about it to me, but Sandy knew that June had brokered some kind of truce. When you see someone every day for a while, you settle into a rhythm and you come to count on them even if for nothing more than the 15 minutes each morning they spend sitting at your counter, on one of your stools, talking about the weather and giving you a big smile and thumbs up when they sink their teeth into a poppy seed muffin. I never talked to Luke about my dad, or Sandy, or Liam, our money troubles, or my mother's second breast cancer scare last year. I don't talk about that stuff with anyone but Sandy. People say Luke was responsible for what happened. That June was dumping him and he wanted to get back at her, or that he was high that night and accidentally left the gas going. For a while, a hateful rumor went around that one of the Moreys from the volunteer fire department found a crack pipe in the kitchen near Luke's body. Sure they did. But facts never got in anyone's way when it came to Luke, so I guess it should be no surprise that the story of what happened that night would be no different. What might have cleared things up would have been a proper investigation. But for reasons that no one can explain, what was left of the house was bulldozed and destroyed before the state could examine the wreckage properly and locate the exact cause of the explosion. The county fire chief told me when I called to ask what the hell was going on that they cleared the site for safety reasons, to prevent accidents, but given that June Reed had no neighbors besides the Moonies and the Episcopal Church down the road, my guess is that it was the town protecting itself from liability. Thoughtless fuckers. One more time the system failed Luke Morey and trampled the facts to serve itself. Funny how no one seemed to mind. June Reed vanished, Lydia Morey quit her house cleaning jobs and now keeps to herself, and the family of the guy who was going to marry Lolly left right after the funerals and went home to California or Washington State, somewhere on the West Coast. There was no one left to push for the truth, and everyone else didn't care. What use was the truth when they had Luke, the ex-con bastard black son of the town floozy who landed in a pot of honey with an older gal from the city? "It follows a logic," one of my customers said at the time. He's an old-timer who comes in every morning for a grilled cheese with egg and coffee, and he's not a bad guy, just an old man who never left this town and never will. I let him finish his toast and sip his coffee, and I didn't say a word. June Reed didn't stick around long enough to clear up any of these stories. I used to get worked up about it, and sometimes I guess I still can, but I've learned that people will believe what they believe no matter what you say or do. What I know about Luke is that he was a friend of mine. He was a good man who had come through some hard times, who got to be happy for a little while. And now he's gone. I didn't want Sandy and Liam to see me blubbering that day, so after I dropped the cake off at the firehouse, I drove to my mother's place. She still lives in the same house I grew up in, the same place where Sandy and I lived when we were trying to get on our feet. Funny how in a small town like ours, things play out, circle back, end up. Who would have thought that one day Earl Morey, with his son Dirk, and all their brothers and cousins, would be eating Brazilian wedding cake made by my mother and meant for the daughter of Luke Morey's older, city-rich girlfriend? No one, that's who. But the crazy, haphazard, upside-down of it all somehow made sense. I sat in my childhood driveway and watched my mother turn on the porch light, something she always does before opening the front door since I was a kid and even in broad daylight. I watched her shut the door behind her and pull her thin house coat tight around her bony shoulders and button the top two buttons. I thought of her squeezing all those damned oranges and cracking all those coconuts for the last 2 days, sprinkling the little silver balls that the Moreys were now crunching in their tobacco-stained teeth down at the firehouse. And then I started to laugh. I couldn't help it. Nothing was funny, not one thing. But it was all so absurd and fucked up. Tears and snot were everywhere, and here was my mother making her way from the stoop to the driveway, shuffling in her slippers, old. She'd left her glasses in the house, and I could see her squinting to see me more clearly. "Rick, you okay?" she asked as she stepped to my side of the car and tapped the window. This was my mother, both hands on the roof of the car, leaning into the window, half blind, worried. Funny how disasters can make you see what you could lose. I don't think I'd ever seen my mother as clearly as I did that day. 66, widowed at 50, a secretary at the elementary school for over 35 years, a single mom who raised two kids, who took care of her granddaughter while my divorced sister went to nursing school in Hartford, a breast cancer survivor who let her grown son move back in with his 19-year-old wife and 1-year-old boy. "You okay in there?" she asked, tapping the window again. "Rick?" I unlocked the door and got out of the car. It was now evening. "Tell me," she said, her hands on my shoulders, her feet balancing on tippy toes. I leaned in and put my arms around her little body. "It was a good cake, Mom," was all I could think to say. They would have loved it. Rebecca. Some days she doesn't come out. Some days you never see so much as a flicker of light behind the curtains. We've gotten used to her, and it's convenient that she pays cash for the room. She leaves a $40 tip each week for Sissy, too, which has to be a record here at the Moonstone. Sissy, like us, is in her early 50s, maybe a bit older. She walks to work from her house down the road, brings our mystery guest a thermos most days and occasionally cookies, and spends nearly an hour cleaning her room when she barely spends 20 minutes in the others. She also, I have seen recently, takes away a small bag of laundry each week from room 6, and returns it the next day, presumably washed and folded. Why this woman would want to stay here as long as she has is not our business, but of course I wonder. When she checked in, she had no ID. She'd lost her driver's license, she explained, and then asked if she could pay cash a month in advance. I called Kelly, who is a better judge of character than I am, to come over from the house before agreeing. She asked the woman how long she planned to stay, and she answered that she didn't know, but she would pay each month up front in cash and wouldn't expect a refund if she left early. Kelly asked her where she was from, and even though she answered vaguely, "Back east," Kelly still turned to me, gave me a wink and a squeeze on my arm, and said to the woman, "Stay here as long as you like." If she were some rough type or strung-out junkie, there's no way we'd go along with it. But this woman could be anyone's mom or wife, and seemed, and still seems, only sad, not dangerous. The night she checked in, I asked her what we should call her, and she said Jane, which of course can't be her real name. But even saying that one word, that fake name, seemed like an effort, and I immediately regretted asking. I walked her out to room 6, the one closest to and facing the ocean, because she'd asked for it specifically. She must have known someone who stayed at the Moonstone once or been here before we owned it. Room 6 also has the best mattress, which we had to buy last year after an older man who'd come down from Seattle for the weekend fell asleep with a lit cigarette in his hand and caught the bed on fire. Burned a hole right through to the other side in the short time it took for him to wake up from the smoke, thank God, and come running to our door in his bare feet and boxer shorts. Which is all to say, since she's staying for as long as she is, I'm glad she's at least sleeping on a decent mattress. When I showed her to the room, I offered to give her a little tour, but she politely declined. She simply unlocked the door with the key, went in without another word, and stayed inside for nearly a week. It was Sissy who got her out of there for the first time. "Ma'am? Ma'am?" she yelled as she knocked. "Out you go, ma'am. Out. I only need a few minutes, but you gotta get out." Kelly and I stood a few doors down to see what would happen. Few people stand up to Sissy. She is tall and thin and strong, with one long braid, once black and now silver, thick as rope, down her back. Her hands are bigger than most men's, and her chest is as flat as a board. She looks like a Native American, but when I asked her once, she didn't answer. Her husband was from a long line of fishermen in Aberdeen, just down at the mouth of Grays Harbor. But he died of lung cancer 15 years ago, and since then she's been living with her sisters, who I think mostly all lost their husbands one way or another and ended up back in the house they grew up in. Sissy has lived here in Moclips all her life and has worked at the Moonstone since her husband died. According to her sister Pam, Sissy's husband left her the house they'd lived in together, which she sold, so I don't think it's the money Sissy is after so much as something to do and somewhere to go each day. Pam is the only real estate agent in Moclips, and the one who sold us the Moonstone from an old couple who'd had it since the 60s. That was 4 years ago. The first morning in our little house next to the Moonstone, Sissy showed up with a blue tin of orange drop cookies and told us what she charged, what time of day she worked, and the week in July she took off every year. I don't remember us offering her the job so much as agreeing to her terms. We didn't find out she was Pam's sister for months. Sissy isn't much for hanging around and gabbing. At first we thought it was because she felt uncomfortable with us because of the gay thing. But when gay marriage was legalized in Washington State this year, she came into the office the morning after the election and said, "It's none of my business, but if you two decide to get legal, I happen to be an ordained minister thanks to the good old internet, and I'd be happy to do the honors." Kelly is hardly ever at a loss for words, but it did take her a few beats to say thank you, and let her know we weren't sure whether we would or wouldn't, and if we did, we'd likely call on her services. Funny how you think people are one way or the other, and most of the time you end up completely wrong. We're still not sure about getting married. We've talked about it, of course, and we cheered the night of the election when we saw on television that voters passed the referendum. But beyond Kelly's brothers and nephews, who we see once or twice a year, neither of us have much by way of family anymore. And we've been together for so long now. 20 years, 21, it's hard to remember. It seems like something to let the young ones get excited about, but you never know. Sissy has never once mentioned her husband, whose name we know is Ben only because Pam told us one night when we cooked her supper. She'd had a few glasses of wine and had been loud and laughing, until the subject turned to Sissy when she quieted to a whisper, as if Sissy could hear from their house down the road. They met at a bar in Aberdeen one night when they were both teenagers. Ben was the only man tall enough for Sissy, is what most people thought at the time. And even though you'd never hear them say much to each other, there was a spark between them, always, a kind of animal energy. Sissy used to say, "I have my sisters for talking and Ben for everything else." They never had kids, neither of them ever went to a doctor to find out why. They just accepted it and went about their lives. They lived in the house 3 doors down from ours for almost 20 years, and Sissy asked me to find a buyer the day Ben died, which was also the day she moved back in with us. I found a buyer a little while later, a couple from Portland who came with their kids to teach at the elementary school. They moved away after the last one went off to college. I think Pam regretted spilling so many beans about Sissy that night, because she's turned down the few invitations we've made since. She's perfectly friendly when we run into her at the grocery store or gas station in Aberdeen, but she keeps her distance. It's hard to believe it's been more than half a year since that morning Sissy pounded on the door of room 6, sounding like some cop on TV. "Ma'am, I have a key, so my knocking is just a formality." "Ma'am, I'm reaching for my key, and this door will open whether you want it to or not." And just as she went for the key, the door opened and Jane stepped out. "Thank you," she said, her hand waving a kind of apology as she pulled her tan coat on. She hurried away, down the steps toward the beach where she stayed most of the rest of the day. Since then, we've seen her wander down the beach for hours, barefoot, with her lace-up tennis shoes in one hand, the other arm usually wrapped around her waist. One morning at the end of the summer, we thought she might have spent the night out there because there was no light coming from her room, no clanking of water pipes or flushing toilet as there usually is. Her lights came on that evening, and we saw the usual shadow passing across her curtains. So wherever she'd been the night before, she made it back in one piece. I think she mainly lives on Sissy's cookies because I've only twice seen her carrying bags from Laird's General Store into the room. Maybe she squirrels packets of nuts or candy bars in her jacket pockets when she goes down to the gas station ATM for cash each month. But if that's what she's doing, I've never seen any of it. What I have seen is Sissy lugging around a large thermos, the kind you carry soup or hot chocolate in. What's inside, I don't know, but neither Kelly nor I ever saw that thermos before Jane came along. We've seen it out on the front stoop of Jane's room in the mornings, too. Sissy isn't one to gossip in general, but when we've tried to talk to her about Jane, she won't say more than that she keeps a tidy room. Even though it's well within our rights to want to know about the only long-term resident of the Moonstone, especially one who checked in under an alias and without ID, we always feel ashamed when we mention her in front of Sissy. And so we don't anymore. We just accept her as part of our lives, a quiet woman named Jane from somewhere east of here. Lydia. The first call from Winton came in December. There are a few things to remember about that day, and she's tried, but the one thing she doesn't struggle to recollect was that the phone hadn't rung for weeks. It's an old beige thing with thick buttons that make loud beeps when you press them, mounted on the wall by the door in the kitchen. It came with the rental she's living in, and carved into the doorframe next to it are phone numbers. She recognized a few when she moved in a little more than 6 years ago. Gary Beck's, for one. He had a funny relationship with her mother and would come by every once in a while with schnapps they'd drink in the kitchen. They both loved country music and listened to a station out of Hartford that played Loretta Lynn and Conway Twitty songs. When Lydia was a teenager and even later, she thought their nights in the kitchen were the grimmest she could imagine, smoking cigarettes, drinking peppermint schnapps, and turning up the radio when some sad song came on. Funny, she thinks now, remembering those nights, how things change when you look at them with older eyes. She wonders if Gary Beck is even still alive. As far as she can remember, he never had a wife or kids or any relations. He wasn't involved in the volunteer fire department or church or any of the organizations that host spaghetti and meatball dinners at the elementary school to raise money. She never saw him outside of her mother's kitchen. He ran the post office in town until he had a stroke and was put in a state home for the elderly in Torrington. That all happened 16 years ago, the year before her mother died. She'd told Lydia about Gary one morning on the phone but didn't convey any emotion, just enough interest to relay the facts. She doubts her mother even went to visit him in Torrington. She never could quite figure out what their relationship was, but as attractive as her mother had been, and as much as she always dolled herself up each morning for work at the bank, she was pretty sure she'd shut the door on men after Lydia's father died. Still, she and her mother had never been what anyone would consider close, and so she wondered if anything more than companionship had gone on with Gary. He was harmless, and he brought booze, and always had a flattering thing to say when her mother opened the door to let him in. "Looking good tonight, Natalie," was as specific and flirtatious as he ever got. He was still coming around when Lydia and Luke moved in with her mother the year he was born. But after that, she never saw him. It was hard for her to imagine who might have needed Gary Beck's number often enough to carve it into this wall. Maybe someone who worked at the post office. Maybe some other old gal he'd bring schnapps to and listen to country songs with. When she looked at the numbers gouged into the pine doorframe, she hoped so. She hoped he had a different one every night. The other names could be anyone's. Lisa, Matthew, Evelyn. Only Gary Beck had the honor of his last name carved into the wood. And then there's the one number she can never forget. Her former mother-in-law's, Connie Morey. The Moreys must have had that same number since telephones were first installed in Litchfield County. The family had been in their old, broken-down house off Main Street since the late 1800s. They built it themselves, as they were all quick to tell you, and were still there. On the wall it just says Connie, and those same digits Lydia used to dial when she was in high school, when Earl Morey was, for a short time, the only person she wanted to speak to or see. He was jumpy and mischievous, a soccer player with a big bush of red hair on his head. He loved the Grateful Dead and ice fishing and smoking pot and could mimic anyone he laid eyes and ears on for more than a minute. His favorite target was his older brother, Mike, who had a lisp and was not very bright. He also did a blistering impersonation of Lydia's mother, which it took her only one time to overhear from her bedroom to run him out of the apartment. Still, she loved him, but more than him, she loved the idea of his family, which was not by any stretch of imagination wealthy. Most of them electricians and house painters and groundskeepers at Harkness, the boarding school just over the town line in Bishop. It was and is their size and longevity that made them formidable. "There is safety in numbers," Lydia's mother would say as she blew clouds of menthol smoke through the kitchen from behind the formica table where she sat each night with her schnapps, like a general at her battle station making speeches to the troops. "I know because I've been out on my own for so long. Even before your father died 100 years ago, it was just us, just him and me, against the world." Safety was not what attracted Lydia to Earl Morey. What she loved about him was that he made her laugh. Sometimes she'd laugh so hard she couldn't breathe, which would egg him on more. In high school, he had a short fuse, was a bit of a bully, and more than a few times was called off the soccer field for instigating fights with players on the other teams. That mean streak made Lydia nervous sometimes, but she told herself he was all talk, harmless, a showboat. And besides, no one could make her laugh as hard as he could. She experienced that laughter as a kind of exorcism. It quieted the voices of the girls at school who whispered behind her back and drowned out her mother's tipsy rants. And for a brief spell, there was nothing but heaving lungs, pounding heart, and tears running down her cheeks. She laughed with Earl for a while before they got married, and not much after. After high school, Earl went to work with his brothers on the maintenance crew at Harkness and joined the volunteer fire department. Within a few months, he stopped coming home for dinner. He'd go straight from work to the firehouse or to the tap, where he'd eat beef jerky and potato chips. He'd come in after 10, drunk and cranky about something or someone. He'd pinch Lydia's ass and tell her to lay off the snacks. And soon he just called her snacks, first at home and then in front of his family. His father thought it was funny. "Toughen up, girl," he said to her at Christmas dinner that first year. "You know how he is." And then there were the nights, in the beginning once every 6 weeks or 2 months, and then later every weekend, when he'd come home smashed and wake her up speaking gibberish. Whether she responded or not, sat up in bed or curled into her pillow pretending to sleep, the result was the same. A hard blow either to the side of her head or her body. Usually it was just one, two at the most, and sometimes afterward he would grab her by the shoulders and shake her violently. Mostly it would be dark, so she wouldn't see him. But the few times he turned on a light, or the moon outside would brighten the room enough, she would see a face so tortured and far away it was as if he were possessed, like some kind of zombie demon. She knew by then that the only thing capable of driving a demon away was another one. So when she recognized something that could drive Earl, and most likely the rest of the town away, she didn't hesitate. That their demon would be her son was the awful consequence, but she didn't think she had a choice. Which was not how other people saw it, certainly not her mother, or Connie Mori, who is long dead and whose number is still, like some threat from the underworld, carved into the wood next to Lydia's phone. She's turned the ringer down as low as it goes, but she still jumps every time it rings, ever since the morning when she got the phone call from Betty Chandler. "He's done it now, Lydia," is what she said, clipped and cold and distant as if she were reporting that the high school football team was on a losing streak. "You need to get over to June Reed's house right away," she added before hanging up. Betty Chandler and Lydia grew up together, went to the same kindergarten, elementary, and high school. They were even best friends one summer and fall when they were 12, making barrettes with pink and blue ribbons and selling them for $1 each. But when Betty's chubby older brother Chip tried to kiss Lydia unsuccessfully after the 8th grade dance, and then told people she let him go to third base, Betty turned on her and spread rumors that she was loose. Just like that, based on so very little, she became her enemy and managed to stay so for more than 30 years. Later, when Luke was born and Earl had thrown Lydia out, her mother said she'd heard Betty telling people she'd been accepting money to have sex with migrant workers at Morgan Farm across the state line in Amina, the ones who came from Mexico or the Caribbean every season to pick apples, and that's how she'd gotten pregnant. Her mother asked her if it was true. As painful as that was, Lydia never blamed her mother or any of them. She knew when she realized she was pregnant that if her baby's skin was even half as dark as its father's, she would be cast as the hussy. She never refuted any of the stories, never told anyone the truth, not even Luke, and when he was old enough, he didn't want anything to do with her, let alone a father who had been kept a secret all his life. There were good reasons for keeping his father a secret, and if they weren't good, they were, she believed for a long time, necessary. Only one marriage would be upended by this baby, and it would be hers. Many times she came close to leaving, throwing Luke in her car and driving away. But somehow she got used to the snickering whispers in the grocery store, the nasty gazes from the women, and the lewd once-overs from the men. 1 year became 2, became 5, became so many she couldn't count them. After Earl, there were other men, but most didn't amount to much more than a few boozy sleepovers. Only Rex, who turned up many years later, stuck around long enough to look like a future, but the wreckage he left in his wake cured Lydia of ever again expecting one. After Rex, there was no more going to places like the Tap on weekends, no more men, and no more hope left that her life would ever happen any differently than it had. Beyond visiting Luke in prison in the Adirondacks the one time, and going to Atlantic City for her honeymoon with Earl, she'd never left Wells. "Some trees love an axe," a drunk old-timer mumbled one night at the Tap, back when she still went there. And something in what he said rang true. But when she later remembered what he'd said, she disagreed and thought instead that the tree gets used to the axe, which has nothing to do with love. It settles into being chipped away at, bit by bit, blade by blade, until it doesn't feel anything anymore. And then, because nothing else can happen, what's left crumbles to dust. After Luke died, the phone rang a lot. The funeral home, the insurance company, the bank, the police. There were consoling calls, too, but mostly from people in Luke's life, not hers. People who adored him and worked with him. Some who were in jail with him, a few old girlfriends, ones she'd never met, and a few guys who used to swim with him in high school, his old coaches. She heard their voices as if they came from the end of a long tunnel. Their words were like echoes, and often she would hold the phone away until she sensed the talking about to come to an end. She did her best to be polite, but it was hard to hear from strangers about her son's life, which she barely knew, and had only just begun to be included in again. Everyone she worked for called. The Moody's, the Hammonds, Peggy Riley, the Tucks, the Hills, and the Masseys, who owned the bed and breakfast in Salisbury where she used to drive each day to change beds, clean linens, and scrub the toilets and tubs. Even Tommy Ball called, though she hadn't seen him in years. All of them offered their condolences, and told her to take time and to please just let them know when she was ready to come back. She never called any of them. But she did take her time. All of it, she mumbled to herself more than a few times. From the age of 13 until the morning Betty Chandler called her, Lydia had worked nearly every day of her life. From that moment forward, she was done. She figured that with the little money she had saved, there was enough to pay her living expenses for a year or so, and carry the minimum payments on her two credit cards if she had to use them to pay for food. Without having to go to work, she barely ever drove, so she didn't have to pay for gas. Propane and electric were included in her rent, which was only $400 a month, and the phone and cable bills were the cheapest possible. It turned out later that Luke had a life insurance policy, and Lydia was, inexplicably, the beneficiary. He also had a will, the kind you download from the internet and get notarized, which he did. He left Lydia what he had, his savings, his landscaping company, and his belongings, which, because he'd been living at June's, were destroyed. Between the insurance and the savings, and the $20,000 the Waller brothers paid her for the landscaping business, two trucks, a few wheelbarrows, a backhoe, and a pile of tools, she could exist as she lived now for a long time without working. For most of her life, she had dreamed of the day she wouldn't have to stoop and scrub and haul and shine for other people. And so it came, one more demon replacing another. June never called, not once. She hugged Lydia briefly at Luke's funeral, but left town before she could say anything. Lydia wasn't surprised, given how she behaved the morning Betty Chandler called. She'd done what Betty had instructed her to do and went straight to June's. She dropped the phone and, in her slippers and robe, drove the 3 miles to Indian Pond Road. June was squatting next to the mailbox, doubled over and away from the house, just at the top of the short, curving asphalt driveway. Lydia got out of her car and went toward her. Around them swarmed what looked like hundreds of firemen and police officers and EMTs. As she came closer, June turned her face away as if avoiding a hot flame, and as she did, held her arm up and flicked her hand toward Lydia, the way you would wave away an unwanted animal or a beggar. It was chilling, even in that unreal scene, to be greeted this way by a woman who had only ever shown her kindness. It is that gesture she remembers most clearly from that morning. Not Betty Chandler's heartless phone call, not the red flashing lights, not the army of stunned emergency workers, not the police officer telling her that her son was dead. It was June's hand sending her away, the first signal that everything was about to change, had already changed, and that she was about to find out how. Those flicking, flapping fingers still jumped before her eyes like a black flag snapping in the wind, commemorating all that was over. But Lydia never blamed her. Not only were her losses greater than Lydia's that day, if losses are measured in people, but June was the one who saw it happen. Whatever she had gone through, whatever she had seen, meant that Lydia was no longer bearable. She assumed that June blamed Luke, like so many others had. But the truth was she had no idea. What Lydia knew was that in addition to the agony of losing Luke, there was a hard and recurring stab of pain from missing June. So strange to miss another woman. This woman who she never believed she could relate to or like, let alone love. And Lydia still loved her. She had given her back her son. When June met Luke, Lydia had not spoken to her son in over 8 years. Not a word since that afternoon in the freezer section of the grocery store. 1 year, and then 8, and then June. She appeared on Lydia's doorstep. After no one answered her knocking, she waited on the front porch. When Lydia came home that afternoon, she saw a woman roughly her own age or older, who looked like every woman she'd ever worked for. Faded jeans, fit, simple but tailored cotton t-shirt, blonde hair with streaks of silver pulled back in a ponytail, flashes of expensive metal at her wrists and throat and ears. She thought at first she was some weekender from the city looking to hire a house cleaner. When she introduced herself as the woman in Luke's life, "We've been living together this year," she said. Lydia immediately asked her to leave. She knew about June Reed. She knew where she lived and where she was from. She'd even once driven by her old stone house on Indian Pond Road between the apple orchards and the fields that led to the Unification Church property. It was surrounded by old pine and locust trees, and in the winter it looked like a Christmas card. She'd overheard people she worked for, people who knew June Reed from the city, mention how she'd taken up with a local guy much younger. And then Bess Tuck, one of her employers who lived in the city during the week, asked her point blank whether Lydia knew whom her son was dating. When Lydia answered that she did not, Bess told her the woman was someone who'd had dinner in this very house, she emphasized, as if it were the most spectacular and impossible coincidence. Lydia knew about June Reed, but had never seen her. And here she was. As much as she'd wondered how Luke was, and what he was doing and whom with, she knew right away she couldn't bear this woman telling her about her son. It was as if she had taken her place or succeeded where she had failed. But even if the kind of love they had was a totally different kind of love than a mother and son's, she didn't want it rubbed in her face by someone whose motives for being with a man so young could not be good. "Leave," she said to her as she struggled to unlock the door to her apartment. "I don't know who you are, and I don't want to. Go away." June came back a few weeks later, and again Lydia rushed inside. But the next time she came, Lydia didn't duck into her apartment or tell her to go. She stood on the porch and let her speak. It embarrasses her to remember, but she was flattered this elegant woman was so determined to spend time with her. After a little while, she asked her in. She stayed, and she talked, and she came again, and after that again. Eventually, Luke came with her. The first few times he barely spoke, and Lydia, terrified she'd say the wrong thing and cause him to storm out, kept quiet. Lydia remembers June teasing Luke about the kids he hired. "Perverts, pickpockets, and potheads," she'd chant, and each time would get a reaction. He'd tried to get mad, but when he did, she would poke him in the stomach or under his arms, and he would, against his will, melt. During those first few sessions, June's light joking was the only sound to break the silence. And as difficult as it was to see Luke so at ease with a woman her own age, she was grateful. Slowly, after a few visits, he began to talk about work. Even ask Lydia questions about the people she cleaned for. And then one morning, before Lydia left for the day, he showed up alone. They sat on the bottom step of her porch, mostly in silence, and watched two teenage boys scrape paint from the fence of a house on Lower Main Street. Eventually, Lydia turned toward Luke and cautiously placed her hand on his shoulder. She began to speak. "Luke, I..." But he interrupted her, rushing his words, which sounded as if he'd rehearsed them. "We'll be okay. I don't ever want to talk about it because there's nothing you can say to change what happened, and I don't want you to try. I'll never understand. I don't want to. But we'll be okay." Before she could respond, he hugged her. Quickly, the first time in years, his neck against her face, his smell, his skin, all of a sudden so close. He stood, and as he turned toward his truck to leave, he stumbled awkwardly and nearly fell. "I have to," he started to say, righting himself, then pausing a beat. "Stop drinking in the morning." A smile flared, his eyes bright. This was less than 1 year before he died. Nothing, and then so much, then nothing. After those first few weeks following the accident, Lydia stopped picking up the phone. Sometimes she'd leave the apartment, walk down to the town green and back to avoid it. Other times she'd just let it ring and ring. She'd turn the volume up on the television to drown the sound out, or if someone kept calling, she'd get in the shower and turn on the radio that hung from the showerhead. Eventually the phone went quiet. When the first call came from Winton, she picked up. It was the day she ran from the women at the coffee shop. When she came home that night, she sat down at the kitchen table. That first flash of anger when she'd heard the women gossiping frightened her, and panic drove her home. But the longer she sat in the kitchen, and the more she replayed what she'd heard, the more that anger returned, and she felt again the hot violence from before. Something about those women, no more careless or cruel than anyone else she'd ever come across, and probably less so than many. Something about what they said and how they said it made her want to hurt someone. That anger and the ugly fantasies it fueled had her shaking.